many states have delegated power to non-state courts. For a lot of people who use these customary courts, they're much more legitimate than the common or civil law courts of the state.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How do courts work? When do they work well? You might think that they'd be impartial, that they'd be neutral, they'd be consistent. Well, that's a tall order in many parts of the global south. But if courts can't adhere to these standards, does that mean they're actually failing? Fiona Shenbai of the University of Maryland is one of the authors of a review of the evidence in what courts actually do in the global south, how they do it, and who they help. And there's some unexpected conclusions. She joins me now. Fiona, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much, Tim. I'm happy to be here.
Fiona, that concept of what a fair court is that I rolled out in my introduction, where does it come from?
Our baseline understanding of judicial fairness and judicial impartiality actually comes from the experience of courts in the global north. So The canonical definition of rule of law, due process, it comes from the experience of advanced industrialized democracies, primarily in North America, but also Western Europe. When our starting point of analysis is how and why courts work in the West, when we bring these models to the global South, this can sometimes lead to the wrong conclusion about whether or not courts in these other contexts are living up to their intended standards. So what we're trying to do in our review is understand how and why courts beyond the global north either conform to or complicate our understanding of judicial power around the world.
And for courts in the global north to work in that way, what sort of conditions do they need?
This is a concept that comes from a famous judicial scholar, Shapiro, the triad logic of conflict resolution. This is a process where two actors are appealing to a third party to adjudicate their conflict. So the three conditions are as follows. First, you need the conflicting parties to actually believe that the third party is impartial. Second, you need the third party to be neutral or not predisposed to favor one disputant or another. And then third, the rationale of adjudication needs to be consistent with pre-existing norms, right? So this idea of precedent. In our review, when we're looking at the literature on the Global South, we're actually relaxing the criteria that judicial bodies are effective only when they're impartial, neutral, and consistent.
Yet, that idea of creating courts that would replicate that global north ideal of what justice is, that has been promoted as part of development. Who's been doing that? Why have they done it? How successful have they been?
A lot of this effort actually began in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union, the rule of law revival. And that was being promoted by the United States, partners in Western Europe. And following the end of the Cold War, a lot of Western governments and non-governmental organizations were championing these ideas of good governance, especially in the global South. Promoting strong courts was part of this broader campaign to fight corruption, instability, and tyranny. It's really embedded in a lot of these programs as the notion that strong courts need strong states. So this is a very deeply held paradigm, not only in the political science literature, but also in policymaking circles. Why was this unsuccessful? Part of the problem is what's been referred to as the fallacy of legalism. This is the belief that the creation of law through formal statutes or legislation or judicial precedent, that's going to be sufficient to bring about social change. Again, this idea has been firmly rooted in the Western experience, where the state has historically served as the enforcer of property rights and contracts. In this view, state weakness is often tantamount to state failure. That's not how it works in the global South, because there are a lot of contexts where the absence of the state does not necessarily mean the absence of rules and order.
So in this paper, you identify three challenges that countries are confronting when they try to organise a court system that might live up to that global north ideal. The first of those is stateness. What does stateness mean?
Stateness is a very broad umbrella concept, but the way that we're thinking about it in this review is it's the extent to which the state actually exercises authority throughout its territory.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically reflecting the degree to which a state enjoys a monopoly on violence. So that's the Klasser-Weberian definition of the state. But it also reflects the creation of laws, but also the administration of public affairs.
If you have a weak state, then in the judicial process, you get non-state actors stepping in. What sort of actors do step in? And can we consider them to be courts if they are adjudicating on things that normally the courts would be adjudicating?
It's a great question. So the kinds of non-state actors that we see coming in to fill the void left by the state in a lot of parts of the global south, they're often customary authorities like traditional elders, especially in the periphery, but also non-governmental organizations. In some cases, even criminal organizations or rebel groups are coming in to fill that judicial vacuum. And whether or not we can consider these bodies that these non-state actors create as courts, well, in very broad strokes, a court is just a forum to adjudicate disputes. So we typically associate these types of bodies with the state, but this is what the Global South research is showing. A lot of non-state forums can actually achieve the same tasks, if not better, than state institutions. These non-state courts, they're often local, maybe they're ad hoc. They can also be more informal than the institutions of the state, but informal also does not mean less binding. There are a lot of circumstances where informal institutions are often more legitimate to the people who use them than the institutions of the state.
This is a concept that makes many people uncomfortable. You mentioned Taliban courts in the paper, which is going to make many people think, uh-oh. In the example that you choose, how did they function? With what result?
There's really fascinating research about Taliban justice that's come out in recent years. And so what this research shows is that the Taliban and the Islamic State has established courts. And these courts practice Sharia law, unsurprisingly, and they are presented as theocratic alternatives to secular courts. What the research is showing is that these courts are actually upholding due process and impartiality in a lot of unstable regions like Afghanistan, which is providing predictability in the legal process for Afghans against the backdrop of civil war, which is pretty incredible. And this upends a lot of preconceptions about Islamic justice, including the fact that there are types of coercion and torture that are commonly associated with the Taliban that factor only into a minority of cases that are adjudicated before these Taliban courts.
You also discuss courts in authoritarian regimes that can be effective, if not what we would conventionally think of as just. If I'm a dictator in that authoritarian regime, what might I want a court to do for me?
The research on authoritarian justice has really proliferated in recent years, and it's shown that for dictators, there are a lot of functions that courts can serve to help address the pathologies of autocratic rule. So one of the most common and generalizable findings is that courts, especially independent courts, can help dictators establish strong property rights. So that can be great for attracting foreign investment. Another thing that courts can do for dictators is they can help monitor administrative conflicts. A lot of the research about Chinese justice has focused explicitly on how litigants are able to bring their grievances against the state to the courts, and that helps the central government monitor conflicts that otherwise they might not have information about. So this type of justice is actually feeding information up to the central government.
Interesting thing about this analysis is that it challenges the conventional wisdom that a dictator would just use the courts to serve themselves, that there are other beneficiaries of this. This is trying to get the state to work well.
Exactly. Yeah. So sometimes dictators are using these institutions to institutionalize the justice process, but that doesn't mean that they're also not using these judicial bodies for their own personal ends.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So there are also circumstances where dictators are using courts to repress. We can also see examples of authoritarians using the criminal justice process to legitimize their rule. Again, to turn to the case of China, we often see courts being used to signal the regime's commitment to upholding populist moral outcomes, even if those outcomes are going against the formal letter of the law.
The second challenge is the instability of any regime within the country. The paper suggests the political competition between groups can weaken courts. I would have thought that it might strengthen the role of courts. How does this happen?
Yeah, this is a really counterintuitive outcome, but there's a longstanding argument that electoral competition is actually really good for sustaining judicial independence. But this is mainly the case in healthy democracies, because you really need independent arbiters to regulate these kinds of disputes, especially electoral disputes, and also to make legislative bargains credible. And the problem is competition can produce divided governments, which can be good for the independence of courts, because this means it might be harder for disparate factions to actually coordinate against judicial decisions that are unfavorable to them. But the challenge is when there is a lot of political instability, as is often the case in weak or emerging democracies, or if there's about to be a regime change, which can really heighten uncertainty, there's uncertainty about how and whether conflicts will actually be resolved. So in these types of situations, competition and judicial independence don't necessarily go hand in hand. Sometimes incumbents are going to pack the courts to enshrine their interests if they expect to leave power. But judges also aren't always passive agents in these outcomes. They can be strategic, too, about trying to align themselves with whomever they think will be the future incumbent. So maybe they'll start ruling in favor of the interests of particular partisan factions. And again, this is something that we're seeing in a lot of Global South contracts, particularly in Latin America.
So how this works out in practice, I guess, depends on the context. It also depends on how the courts see their own role.
Exactly. When courts see themselves as independent arbiters of law, if there's a strong sense of judicial corporatism, this can also be strongly influenced by the degree of connectivity between judicial actors in the Global South and the Global North. So when they see themselves as part of this international community, that can affect the degree to which they feel supported enough to resist these potentially authoritarian entrenchments on the bench.
The third challenge that you pick out is social integration. If there is a divided society and there are demands that courts become a catalyst for change, how can they be effective? Through what mechanisms can they be effective? Well, I mean, can they be effective?
Access to justice and legal mobilization are two really key steps towards social transformation, and developing a legal conscience is an essential first step. So there's a lot of research, both in Latin America and China, that's showing how the ways that people understand the law, are trained about the law, and interact with the law can really affect how they move through these systems and potentially are able to transform them from the bottom up. It's important to also think about the support structures that exist outside of the judiciary, so especially civil society organizations. These can not only help educate people about the judicial process, but also ultimately support their claims once they get to court. I'm talking about law societies, bar associations, but also even prosecutors and lawyers and human rights groups. And all of these actors acting in concert can help citizens understand their own place within this broader legal framework.
So Fiona, you spoke earlier about that fallacy that passing laws and having them implemented by courts necessarily creates the social change that we might want. We've also talked a great deal about just how difficult it is to create courts that implement the standards of justice that many of us might implicitly think that they should. Does this mean, therefore, we should give up on the effort to reform courts or just recalibrate our standards for how we pursue that reform in the Global South?
So first of all, never give up. But my longer response to that is that a lot of that thinking is really a top-down perspective of social transformation. Mm-hmm. And this, again, is rooted in our state-centric understanding of judicial development and even judicial power. But a top-down perspective is really only half the story, because what's actually happening on the ground in a lot of these contexts in the Global South is a bottom-up transformation, but it's also a complex back-and-forth interaction between state and societal actors. We should really think critically about what reform actually means in these contexts, specifically reform to what ends, to whose standards. And this is why a recalibration of reform in the abstract is really necessary. So, for example, access to justice is a huge problem in a lot of contexts where the reach of the state is limited. Rather than try to expand the presence of state courts, something that is often prohibitively costly, both in terms of time and money, many states have delegated power to non-state courts. In Africa, these are often customary institutions. As I mentioned earlier, for a lot of people who use these customary courts, they're much more legitimate than the common or civil law courts of the state.
We've also spoken about how courts interact with authoritarians in many countries across the Global North and the Global South. There are threats to democracy. If an incumbent really wants to end democracy, is there a limit to what courts can effectively do about that?
Courts are in a really tricky position, especially in regimes that are experiencing democratic backsliding. Courts often become easy targets. It goes back to this famous quip from Madison, you know, courts have neither the power of the purse nor the sword. And so that makes them an easy target for hostile rhetoric, legislative threats, sometimes pressure to resign, both formal and informal, and also court packing. And it's especially difficult for courts to fight back if they lack broader public legitimacy or public trust. Some recent research has shown that courts are neither impartial nor neutral, but they can still stabilize a democracy when parties to a conflict are ultimately uncertain about each other's political intentions. And this is presuming that both sides uphold the principle of competitive elections. But the problem is, once a party, and this is especially true for incumbent parties, lose their commitments to democracy, there is nothing a court or a judiciary can really do to stop it. So it really is up to non-judicial actors to come together and do the work of helping to support these courts.
So reading your review, it's a great insight into how courts sometimes work well where we wouldn't expect them to, and vice versa as well. Given the institutional differences around the world, the differences in context, can we possibly learn what works well in a systematic way and how to implement that to get the best possible courts?
This was a key motivation for Julio and I to do this review, because really what we wanted to establish was whether we could recalibrate the analytical baseline from the north to the south. And that's really what's so valuable about research on the courts in this region, because it's showing us how courts have often been designed and operated under very different circumstances for very different objectives. Mm-hmm. And effective reform, again, requires understanding that local context and custom, but also even expectations for what these reforms were intending to do. There's no way to get around this other than directly engaging with the courts themselves, understand how they're working in practice. One of the most exciting empirical developments on this front has been the digitization and publication of judicial data around the Global South. And this has been a boon not only for scholars like myself, but also for practitioners, because judges, lawyers, and even litigants from these regions are able to access these data for free. And that's also helping them understand these broader patterns and trends and understand how the law works in their local context. The explosion of this freely accessible data on everyday jurisprudence in the Global South is helping us understand when, why, and how people are using courts in ways that can critically inform our attempts to reform these bodies.
Fascinating area with huge potential, not just for more research, but to make courts that do work well and in the interests of the people that they're meant to serve. Fiona, thank you for doing the research. Thanks for talking about it.
Thanks so much for having me, Tim.
The The paper is called Courts in the Global South. It was published in the Annual Review of Political Science in 2025. That's volume 28. The authors, Julio Rios Figueroa and Fiona Shen Bai. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode? You know what I'm going to say. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. Our past episodes, as always, are voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. And if you like what you just heard, tell someone about us. Leave us a review.
Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.